Harris held a rally in Madison, a city where she spent part of her childhood.
All right, Madison, are we ready to do this? Are we ready to vote? Are we ready to win? Oh, it's good to be back in Madison. It's good to be back.
As Harris spoke, a group of peaceful protesters could be heard yelling, "Ceasefire now," from two corners of the arena. Some held a banner reading, "No fundraising for war crimes." This was her response.
We have an opportunity Listen, we all want the war in Gaza to end and get the hostages out. And everyone has a right to be heard, but right now I am speaking.
Meanwhile, Kamala Harris was greeted with an editorial in the Capital Times headlined, "Welcome home, Kamala. Madison will put you over the top." For more, we're joined in Madison by John Nichols, the nation's national affairs correspondent, who has a new piece headlined, "Trump's not the only top Republican whose fascism is showing." John is the author of more than a dozen books, including his latest, co-written with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, titled, "It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism." John, thanks for joining us. Why don't you start off by talking about Kamala Harris's roots in Madison, Wisconsin, and also lead into the Wisconsin Senate race.
Well, that's a lot of territory and important all around. Thanks for having me on, Amy. And you're right to focus on Wisconsin. It is an incredible battleground tonight. Donald Trump and Kamala Harris literally could have passing motorcades in Milwaukee. But yes, Kamala Harris has roots in Madison, Wisconsin. Her parents were immigrants, a mother from India, a father from Jamaica. They met in California around Berkeley. They were participants at a club where folks talked about imperialism and colonialism and the changing world at that time. They were both brilliant academics, very progressive activists. And when they got their degrees from Berkeley, they were looking for places to work, and they traveled around the country. It worked on different campuses at times. They spent a year or so in Madison, Wisconsin, where their young daughter, Kamala, she recalls playing along Lake Mendota. I've been with her at the home where she grew up, and we've talked a lot about her parents. Her father was a pioneering economist in many areas. He was one of the first black faculty members at the University of Wisconsin in the area of economics. Her mother, a very brilliant cancer researcher. And she really did grow up as a very young girl for a time in that Madison environment before her parents ultimately went back to California. And her mother went back. The parents divorced. But Madison is a part of her story.
And her father became the first the first tenured black economist at Stanford in California.
Absolutely. He's a brilliant man. And also one of the most honored economists in the Caribbean, receiving major awards in Jamaica for the work that he did with multiple prime ministers as regards the Jamaican economy. And her mother, too. Just if you look at her academic record and her work on breast cancer, especially. Her parents are a remarkable pair of people. And you know, in politics, we don't explore the family as much sometimes, I suppose. But with Kamala Harris, when you talk to her, what you find is she really does speak it with great depth and passion about her mother, especially, but about her upbringing. And we could go on. We could talk for a very long time about it because it's a good story. And I wrote a lot about it. But you also asked about the Wisconsin Senate race,
which could determine the balance of the Senate.
Yeah, that's why it's a big deal. Look, here's the reality, and we should put it in perspective. If Kamala Harris is elected president on Tuesday or after a very long count in lots of battleground states, the first question is, how will she be able to govern? Similarly, that's true also, obviously, for Donald Trump. And that comes down to the Senate, because the Senate will confirm cabinet picks. It will confirm judicial picks. There are just so many ways in which the Senate is essential It's not the only essential body. Obviously, the House matters a great deal. But this fight for control of the Senate is real. And the fact is that the Democrats now have a very narrow, the narrowest majority. They're going to almost certainly lose a seat in West Virginia, the seat that was Joe Manchin's. They are in danger of losing a seat in Montana, which is a state where John Tester has been the senator for a long time. Tester's holding on. I don't necessarily like the analyses that write him off because he's had a remarkable run of winning in a very, very Republican state. But it's a tough race this year. So the Democrats face the prospect of losing control of the Senate. We can talk in a moment about a couple of other states that are really interesting and might flip that back. But Wisconsin is really central to that. And it's an interesting thing. Tammy Baldwin, the senator from Wisconsin, a reasonably progressive Democrat, has won by pretty good margins in the past. This year, she is facing an onslaught. Her opponent is a incredibly wealthy man who started his campaign by pouring, you know, millions of dollars of his own money in. Now he's received huge infusions of money from national Republican and conservative PACs. And so the airwaves in Wisconsin are filled with brutal attacks on Tammy Baldwin, very, very personal attacks. She is an out lesbian, and they've actually had ads attacking her that show images of her partner and, you know, all sorts of, you know, attacks on her partner as well as her. And so it's become an ugly race in many senses. The polling shows that Tammy Baldwin's still a little bit ahead. And frankly, this seat, as well as a couple others, these are critical because there's no way that Democrats can control the Senate if Tammy Baldwin loses in Wisconsin, or if Sherrod Brown, frankly, loses in Ohio. And the interesting thing about Baldwin, and one quick thing that I'll note with her, is she's a fascinating figure because to a greater extent than almost anyone except Bernie Sanders, she has focused on industrial policy, on trade, on economics, on a host of working class issues, on getting pensions back for workers who lose them when a plant closes, things like that. That's still a big part of all her ads. And so Wisconsin becomes a real test of whether somebody who's put a heavy duty emphasis on those economic issues can overcome a lot of the personal attacks.
I mean, this whole issue of Tammy Baldwin being attacked as an LGBTQ person, and then in Wisconsin, Eric Hovda, her opponent, will not reveal his ultimate wealth. Is that right? It's around something like $200 million or more. And then you have Montana, John Tester up against Tim Sheehy. I remember being on the floor of the Republican convention when Sheehy got up and said, that's right, my name is Sheehy. Those are my pronouns. She, he. There's this obsession around the issue of gender. But then, you know, just as you've interviewed Kamala Harris a number of times through her career, if you can talk about another man you've been following in Nebraska and talk about this very unusual race taking place there.
It's an absolutely fascinating race in Nebraska. I went out there and spent some time this summer and traveled around with Dan Osborne, who is running for the U.S. Senate as an independent against a Republican incumbent, Deb Fischer. And the interesting thing about Dan Osborne is that he's not a career politician by any measure. He's a machinist. He was a leader of the bakery, confectionery, and tobacco and grain millers union at the Kellogg's plant in the Omaha area. He led a strike there. It was a pretty bitter, pretty intense strike. And he got a lot of attention. He was on television quite a bit. And there were people who approached him and said, hey, you know what? You should run for the U.S. Senate. Dan Osborne said, you know, I might do that, but I won't do it as a Republican and I won't do it as a Democrat. I will do it as a stone cold independent who has objections to both parties. And so he's mounted this very populist campaign. He campaigns in union halls. He campaigns in community centers, driving thousands of miles across Nebraska in a truck with his picture on the side of it. And I can tell you that his economic positions are a stark critique of, the power of corporations and the attacks on unions. He's very, very focused on that. And he has done remarkably well in connecting with working class people across Nebraska. Now, Nebraska is a pretty Republican state, has a great Democratic Party that has you know, pretty innovative leadership, folks who are tied to Bernie Sanders. And so they've really built the party up a lot. But it's still a Republican state by and large. And what Osborne has done, and I've seen him do it in meetings with groups of people, you know, he has spoken to obviously Democrats, but also he's spoken to Trump supporters. And he will sometimes disagree with them on some of the issues or some of the things they bring up. But he draws the conversation always back to those economics, that stark critique of corporations and of the harm they've done to working class people and the industrial setting, but also on farms. And the polling shows that he has closed the gap to a point where he could actually win this race.
As an independent in Nebraska, John, talk about what's happening here, where Democracy Now! Is in New York. People were floored a few years ago when one House race after another went to Republicans. It was a surprise upset. Talk about these congressional races and what they mean today in 2024.
Yeah, it's a wild thing that New York State, which is obviously a very, very Democratic state, could well tip control of the U.S. House of Representatives. And this is a big deal. It is true that in 2022, you saw a number of seats flip to the Republicans. Many of those seats remain competitive. And the real fascinating thing is that 2022 was an off-year election with a governor's race. This is a so-called on-year election with the presidential race. And you've covered very well the rally that Trump did at Madison Square Garden. That was seen in the national context. But remember, in New York, here was the former president of the United States and people around him, his supporters, saying incredibly brutal things about all sorts of constituency groups in New York State. This is a big deal. If, in fact, there is a big turnout of Democrats in New York State, not a competitive state, for Kamala Harris at the presidential level, that could have a real impact on 3, 4, even 5 congressional seats. What I'm looking at in the polling suggests that Democrats could pick up several seats in New York, as many, again, up to 5 if things go very, very well for them. That would very possibly tip control of the U.S. House of Representatives, because right now Republicans have a 3-seat majority. Democrats really, because of redrawing of lines around the country, they need to pick up at least 5 seats, and obviously they want more. When I look around the country, New York is one of the 2 states where they could pick up, just in 1 state, they could pick up enough to flip control. The other is California. There's a number of competitive seats out there. It's very, very important to understand that the forced redrawing of lines in a couple of southern states, Alabama and Louisiana, has created 2 new seats in overwhelmingly black constituencies that could well elect Democrats. And then, you know, we could go around the country, Amy, but the fact of the matter is that Democrats are in reasonably good position to take the House of Representatives. And where you may see it happen is, as you suggest, in New York State.
Finally, John, you've written a piece on how Kamala Harris can win, her so-called closing argument, how Harris can win Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and the presidency. You write, Harris's closing argument should be about more than the fact that Trump sought to overturn the results of the 2020 election, has since embraced an increasingly authoritarian, even fascistic politics. It has to include a strong pro-choice appeal, loud defense of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Take it from there.
Well, what I believe strongly is that the Harris campaign, it has delivered some good messages about Trump, but they need to understand that at the doors, people want to talk about economics. I was with a guy named Steve Bauer out in Jefferson, Wisconsin, a real swing county, very competitive. This guy's been doing doors since May. I asked him just yesterday, what do you hear about at the doors? You know, what are you hearing? Do you hear about these democracy issues that are so important and that Steve thinks are super important? He says, well, you know, the truth of the matter is what I hear about is the economy. What I hear about is jobs and the impact of trade policies and things like that. And this is the bottom line, Amy. What I argued in my piece is that Kamala Harris actually has a good argument to make. Donald Trump, when he was president, restructured NAFTA and turned it into something else, created a new version of NAFTA, if you will. That has not worked well. Sean Fain, the leader of the United Auto Workers, refers to it as Trump's NAFTA and says it's been devastating for auto workers and other industrial workers across the country. I'm surprised that Harris hasn't put more emphasis on this in the closing days of the campaign, because the fact of the matter is, Economic issues are huge in this campaign. And there really is a way for Harris, who, by the way, voted against Trump's NAFTA, to deliver a powerful economic message. And I think if her campaign is smart in these closing days, they will dial up a lot of that economic messaging, because I do think that it is what people, especially at the doors in these battleground states, want to talk about.
John Nichols, I want to thank you for being with us, the nation's national affairs correspondent. His latest piece, and we'll link to a lot of them at The Nation, Trump's not the only top Republican whose fascism is showing. He's going to be talking about, he in the article talks about House Speaker Johnson, and that's who we're going to talk about next. John, we hope to talk to you in the Election Night Special Democracy Now! Is doing. It's a four-hour Election Night Special, 8 to midnight. People can check it out. That's Eastern Time at democracynow.org, and expanding to 2 hours on the morning after Wednesday, November 6th from 8 to 10. And any show, TV or radio station can take these broadcasts. Next up, what's that little secret between Trump and Johnson? We'll speak with Ellie Mistel about how Speaker Mike Johnson could help install Trump as president. Find out how. Kirstie McCall. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with the nation's justice correspondent, Ellie Mistel, whose new piece out this week is headlined, That Little Secret Between Trump and Johnson? Here's what it could mean. It refers to a comment Trump made at his racist Madison Square Garden rally in New York last Sunday about how House Speaker Mike Johnson could help install Trump as a president through a contingent election in which the House, not the Electoral College, determines the president.
You know, with me, we got to get the congressman elected and we got to get the senators elected, because we can take the Senate pretty easily. And I think with our little secret, we're going to do really well with the House, right? Our little secret is having a big impact. He and I have a secret. We'll tell you what it is when the race is over.
He and I have a secret. We'll tell you what it is when the race is over. And clearly, President Trump is concerned. Pieces in the Washington Post, Politico headline, Trump lagging an early vote with seniors in Pennsylvania, a red flag for GOP. For more, we go to Ellie Mistel. He is author of Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. Ellie, welcome back to Democracy Now! Okay, what is this little secret?
Yeah, so it's really the 12th Amendment. One of the reasons you have to ask yourself, why is Donald Trump and his group of MAGA people stomping around the country, calling Puerto Ricans garbage, and generally acting like they don't need to get any more votes to win the presidency? And the reason why they think that they don't need any more votes is comes from the 12th Amendment. The 12th Amendment is where you get to these contingent election scenarios. What the 12th Amendment says is that the winner of the presidency is determined by whoever has a majority of the electoral votes among the electors appointed. Right. And that's the key phrase. If you do not get to a majority among the electors appointed, then you kick it to the House. And that's where you have the contingent election, where, importantly, the House votes based on its own state delegation. So basically, every state gets one vote. Currently, there are 26 delegations that are Republican, 24 Democrats. So Trump would win in that contingent election of the House. But that's not the secret. The secret is that if you decrease the number of electors appointed, right, the math is simple, that the majority of electoral votes that you need also goes down. So in a very simple case where we think it is you need 270 electoral votes to win if there are 538 total electors. But if you take that number down to, say, 528 electors, well, then all of a sudden you only need 264 electoral votes to win, right? And you can do that. You can decrease the number of electors appointed if you prevent, delay, obfuscate the ability of any particular state to certify its elections and send electors to Congress by the statutorily required deadline of December 11th. And so, Amy, I think that's where this whole game is going to be played by Trump and Johnson. They're going to try to prevent states from submitting, states that Harris wins, from submitting valid states of slates of electors by the December 11th deadline. And then once we get to that deadline, Mike Johnson, as Speaker of the House and Republicans in control of the House, will simply call the process over and say any electors not appointed by the statutory deadline of December 11th simply don't count. And that is a way for Trump to steal an election that he loses.
And for people who are watching this globally, Ellie, for people who don't understand the Electoral College, and there are movements to change it, like the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, designed to ensure that the candidate who received the most votes nationwide as elected president would come into effect only when it could guarantee that outcome. What this system is that we have that they're finagling with right now?
Yeah, so for people who are not from America, who are, like, trying to figure out what's going on, I believe the scientific term for the Electoral College is stupid, right? The Electoral College is anti-democratic and dumb. If you're living in some other country and you have been told that America is the greatest democracy on earth, you have been sold a lie. We are not the greatest democracy on earth. We are not even a true democracy because of the Electoral College, right? The Electoral College, which has always been a part of our history, of our nation, it's always been part of the structure of the government, is fundamentally an anti-democratic system for the single elected official, the single representative that is supposed to be elected by all the people of the United States, right? Everybody else, it's based on their county, their town, their state. The president of the United States is the one official that's supposed to be elected by everybody, but he's actually elected by he or she one day, hopefully soon, is elected by nobody because of the Electoral College. It is a ridiculous system. It's an anachronistic system, basically, you know, like so much else in the Constitution, made to, it's another one of those poison pills the enslavers put into the original Constitution in hope that it would make it very difficult for slavery to ever be outlawed in this nation. And while we overcame slavery, its fundamental structure of allowing for minoritarian white rule is still in place, and we still see the effects, and that's what we're looking at in this election. We got to remember, Donald Trump is most likely, you know, regardless of what happens on Tuesday in the Electoral College, Donald Trump is almost certainly going to lose the popular vote for the third time. For the third time in a row, this man will have a minority of the popular vote, yet still could be president either by winning the Electoral College outright or by gaming the system, as I've outlined in my piece in The Nation.
Tell us more about what you wrote about deadlines, that what this means is that Republicans just have to delay long enough to pass those deadlines. They don't have to win. They just have to stall. And we're seeing more and more across this country these complicated local election laws that have to do with counting. You know, we're doing an election special at night, an election special the next morning, when we very possibly might not know what the election results are, even the next morning.
Yeah, delay, delay, delay is the name of the game for the Republicans. Statutorily speaking, electors have to be submitted to Congress by December 11th. Statutorily speaking, those electors have to vote and then submit their votes on who the president should be by December 25th, Christmas Day, because we are that kind of stupid, right? January 3rd is when the new House takes office. That's a constitutional deadline, so no shenanigans are applicable there. And January 6th, as the violent MAGA people know, is the date when the House certifies the results of the Electoral College vote. But that date is largely ceremonial. Even Mike Pence understands that date is largely ceremonial. The real action is on between December 11th, when the electors are appointed, and December 25th, when they're supposed to be done voting. Now, those deadlines are statutory. That means they can be changed. And if you roll the tape back to 2020, when Nancy Pelosi is the Speaker of the House and the Democrats control the House, one would imagine that if states had gotten cute with their, you know, delaying submitting their slates of electors, Nancy Pelosi would have just extended the deadline. But this is why Speaker of the House Mike Johnson is critical to Trump's secret plan to steal the election. Because if Mike Johnson's in charge, which he absolutely will be, even if Democrats win the House, Mike Johnson's in charge on December 11th. If he's in charge, then he could not move the deadline, essentially, and declare the process over. Now, let's say Democrats win the House, right? Let's say January 3rd, Democrats come in, Hakeem Jeffries is the new Speaker of the House. Could the Democrats undo what Mike Johnson has done on December 11th and December 25th? Maybe. But as my colleague John Nichols just reminded us all, Democrats probably ain't going to control the Senate on January 3rd. So you generally need a bicameral proposition to move deadlines like that. You're probably not going to have the Senate, even if the Democrats win the House. But more importantly, and you know, people who know my beat will not be surprised about what I'm about to say. But if you set the deadline on December 25th, and on December 25th you say, okay, Trump is the president now because we didn't count the electors from Wisconsin and we didn't count the electors from Pennsylvania. Let's say that happens, right? Well, now Hakeem Jeffries comes in, we change the rules, whatever. That's called a lawsuit, right? And that ends up in front of the Republican-controlled Supreme Court, which we have already seen go to great lengths to protect Donald Trump, to protect his candidacy, and to protect his ability to become president again. So even if Jeffries and the Democrats win the House and take over on January 3rd, by then you're putting it all into, like, all roads lead to the Supreme Court, and the Republicans, MAGA Republicans and their wives, control the Supreme Court. So as I say in my piece, I mean, you're everybody likes to say, like, we're close to a constitutional crisis. Now, we in a constitutional crisis now, bro. And what happens after that, it's anyone's guess.
Ellie, you have an interesting piece in The Nation. Black men will vote for Harris. White men are the problem. I mean, I think a lot of the emphasis came when President Barack Obama started to appeal to black men. You say, why is the media talking so much about the fraction of black men who might go MAGA when more than 60% of white men will vote for Trump?
Yeah, I think the focus on black men has been a complete media, you know, red herring, right? People have been worried about it. I saw a poll recently or post recently saying, like, it looks like Trump's support with black men could be evaporating. Evaporating? It was never there. All right, Trump is going to get the same black men to vote for him who voted for him last time, who voted for him in 2016, who voted for Mitt Romney in 2012, who voted for John McCain in 2008. He's going to get 10 to 15% of the black male vote because there are 10 to 15% of black males are Republicans. And they like Republican things, like shooting Liz Cheney, apparently. That's a Republican thing that apparently a lot of black men, that 15% of black men like. But that's it. And that's always it. And it's never more than that, right? Conversely, we live in a country. Conversely, we live in a country where somewhere around 60% of white men will vote for the adjudicated rapist Donald Trump. And that is our problem in this country, not the 10 to 12 to 15% of black men who are going to vote Republican.
Ali Misdal, we want to thank you for being with us, the nation's justice correspondent. We'll link to all your pieces, including that little secret between Trump and Johnson. Here's what it could mean. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! War, Peace, and the Presidency. On Tuesday, November 5th, I'll be joined by Juan Gonzalez, Nermeen Sheikh, and guests from around the country for a live election night special. I hope you'll tune in at democracynow.org from 8 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time for our one-of-a-kind reporting and analysis on this critical election.